Let me start by introducing myself. My name is Yves Houlier. I'm a solution architect for Capgemini Belgium. Furthermore, I'm also very active in the community. I'm an MVP for Windows Azure. I run a user group here in Belgium for the Azure community, AZUG. And furthermore, I'm also a contributor to open source, and more specifically, the in-service bus framework. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. I have a blog pretty dedicated to this topic, which is cloudshaper.wordpress.com. So everything that I tell you today, you can also find it on that blog. And furthermore, I've also started my own personal project using in-service bus at hoeleef.com. And I will use that site as an example for the talk today. So if you want to, you can try everything out during the presentation online. Okay, let me skip to the first page. It's not pleasant. What am I going to do with the next one?
Control,
okay. Okay, so the agenda for today, first I would like to take you through the basic concept of in-service bus. What it is and why it's so well suited for Azure development. Furthermore, from that you will see that in-service bus supports a number of communication patterns. I will dive into those, and I will give you an example from the site that I mentioned, my own personal project. Once we've done that, I will use samples from the site to show you how to do it using in-service bus. So I will give you some basics of how to develop within service bus, no in-depth things, but just basics. And finally, I will conclude with some Azure-specific implementation details. I will try to keep those briefly. Right? So there's a lot of options to play with on Windows Azure, but you can check out all of those details on my blog afterwards. Okay. So in-service bus. Before you can understand what in-service bus as a framework is like, you have to understand what it means to have what's called a service bus. Now, a service bus is actually an architectural pattern. So it's nothing but a piece of paper with a description on it of how components or services and their consumers should talk to each other. The goal of the pattern is actually to simplify communication between different participants in a conversation. And participants in this case means instances in Windows Azure or services that you have on-premise or other pieces of software that need to talk to each other. Now, the pattern itself is based on loosely coupled messaging. That means that different participants in the conversation will not talk to each other directly through, for example, request reply or request response messaging patterns. They will not use, for example, web services. They will use loosely coupled mechanisms, both in space. That means that they share a contract, which is actually the definition of the messages that they can exchange with each other, as also in time. So a typical service bus implementation has some kind of queue or some kind of buffer between the different participants so that one of them can stop listening at a certain time while not interrupting the entire conversation. And basically, it comes down to how humans communicate through email. Right? Two humans each have an inbox or a queue where messages arrive, and you read them whenever it suits you. That's the basic pattern behind a service bus. Now, that really sounds simple, but if you actually want to build something like that, there are quite a lot of distractions from what you would like to do. You have to do things like multi-threaded message handling. You have to make sure addressing is properly done, that the messages arrive at the correct endpoint. You need to handle your transactions, lots of things. And to be honest, it doesn't really have any value to you. Besides that you're loosely coupled and that your application is distributed, it doesn't add to the business value of your application. So that's why I've decided to help the in-service bus team on supporting the framework on top of Windows Azure. And Service Bus itself is actually nothing but a logical service bus. So it's a framework, a set of DLLs, a set of libraries that help you build this architectural pattern and make it very, very easy to develop distributed applications with this pattern without having to care about the underlying infrastructure. It's essentially an abstraction layer over communication mechanisms, and you can put anything underneath that you want, as long as it can support messaging. So that means that we can use technologies like Amazon Q or technologies in Azure like the storage queues or the service bus queues, or even if you want to, you can do messaging over FTP. That's all just a switch that you need to enable in a service bus, and you can do messaging over all of those kinds of infrastructures. And this makes it very, very interesting from a development point of view, because you can simply focus on building your business logic and your domain logic, and you do not really have to care about what sits beneath. You still need to be aware, of course, but you do not have to think about it while implementing your solution. Now, and Service Bus itself consists of a bunch of parts. And one of those parts is the one that you will always need. That's called the core. It's an assembly called andservicebus.core and a couple of satellite assemblies. That's what the framework is like. So that's a DLL. But besides just simply having the DLL, we also implemented for you a couple of processes that are very common in solutions. And for Azure, this means only three types of processes for now, but there are others for on-premise development on top of Amazon Q. So for Azure, you will find two types of hosts. One is the regular host, which will be actually considered a worker role in Azure. The other one is a dynamic host, which is a logical worker, it's one physical worker role, but it's logically it contains multiple worker roles. So you can actually combine the code of multiple logical worker roles and put them all on one machine, just simply to save some money, or if you don't need the capacity of a full machine for your role, that's a good way out. And then furthermore, you have your timeout manager. Timeout manager is actually a scheduler that will send messages to you at a specific time interval or a specific moment. I will talk a lot more about the timeout manager later when we discuss some of the parts of the core, because you need it only in one of those situations. As I said, besides for Azure, there are a lot of other processes out of the box, mostly for on-premise development to pass firewalls. Usually that's the rule, that we want to pass a firewall in some kind of way, and we want to do it in a transactionally reliable way. But as in Azure, everything is accessible by HTTP anyway, so we don't need all of those things. Okay, so why is Service Bus as a framework such a good match with Azure? Well, in fact, both share the same goal, but at a different level. Both want to make building scalable distributed applications a breeze. Right? Azure does it at the infrastructure level, while Service Bus does it at the development level. So Azure provides all the means that we need to make sure that the Service Bus framework can abstract everything away. Service Bus only needs two kinds of storage, basically. One is we need queued storage to ensure that messages arrive at the different participants in a conversation. And we have two options here in Azure. One, we have storage queues, and the other one, we have service bus queues. Right? So we have choice. Furthermore, we also need some storage facilities. Even here, we have some choices. First, we have Azure storage services, which contain a hierarchical database called table storage, and also a blob database, file type database called blob storage. And besides that, we also have SQL Azure, so if you want relational storage, it can also be used by a service bus for storing different kinds of things. So we have all the primitives to support the framework, and the framework will allow us to build distributed applications in a very, very simple way. Okay. Now, I already talked that, and Service Bus has the goal to simplify everything, to abstract away and to make sure that you do the correct things, basically. That's why NServiceBus only supports a handful of communication patterns. We do this intentionally. Our framework is sometimes called moderately opinionated. I would say it's opinionated. If you want to do something that doesn't fit the programming model that we want you to have, we will not support it. Okay? Even if you ask, we will not support it. We have a very opinionated way of building services, and we want to prevent you from shooting yourself in the foot by giving you too many options. Now, a couple of those opinions are very different from what you might be used to from on-premise development. And one of them is that all the components in the system are to be completely autonomous. So we do not share anything between different participants in a conversation. Right? Everything has its own process. Everything has its own queue. Everything has its own storage or data store. Nothing is shared, okay? Besides then the contract of the messages that are to be exchanged. But also if you make the correct choices, you do not share anything physically there. It's only the logical contract in a loosely coupled way, like, for example, XML or JSON. Furthermore, we only support communication that is asynchronous, queued, and durable. So if a certain mechanism requires a service bus to wait for a certain message or a certain response, we will not do it. Okay? It's always asynchronous. We will not allow you to communicate over anything else but queues that are durable. So if a certain construct also gives you the ID of a queue, but it will expire after an hour, and we will not use it. Okay? So it must be durable. And also, as I said, only a couple of patterns are supported, and this is really on purpose, so that you can only do those things that do not limit scalability in the end. Okay, one of those patterns that we do support is one-way communication. So a client, in case of Windows Azure, this will probably be a web role, but it could also be an on-premise desktop application, could be anything really, which will send a message to a specific queue, and a specific queue is always dedicated to a single role in Azure. Right? I say role, there will be multiple instances of that role potentially, but logically it's only one piece of software that can read from a single queue. That's the pattern. It will just send the message and forget about it. A pattern that is kind of similar to request response is full duplex, which actually means that a client will send a one-way message to the worker, which will send a one-way message back sometime. Right? The client can decide to wait for it or not. That's the client's problem. But if you want to do something request response like, then this is the pattern to choose from. But it's decoupled in time, so the time between sending a message and receiving another one is not set. You can set a timeout if you want to wait, of course, but don't always expect one back. Now, the more interesting ones is publish-subscribe, in which that a bunch of clients with all their own destination queue will be listening for messages coming from a single source somewhere else in the system. So this is typically a PubSub pattern where one worker will send messages to everybody that cares about it, about that message. Of course, there needs to be some kind of exchange between the client and the worker in this case about what messages is the client interested in. That's all done for you automatically. So whenever a client boots, it will look at the types of messages that it's interested in, and it will send a subscription message to the worker so that the worker knows that whenever he wants to call somebody that has that kind of message is going to be sent, that every single client is in the communication. Important in this pattern is that there is no middleman. So the client and the worker will communicate with one another at startup to determine who can or who is interested in what message, but there is no middleware in between, or there don't has to be middleware in between. It can be done with middleware like the Azure Service Bus, but it can also be done without middleware, like, for example, the storage queue. Okay. The next pattern, which is probably the most interesting of them all, is what is called a saga. A saga, as the name implies, is a long story. So a long-running workflow is probably what you can compare with it best. But with one mega difference is that in a long-running workflow, there is one single process in the middle that actually manages the workflow and that will call out to the different participants in the conversation. But in a saga, all of the aspects of communicating with one another is local to the participant. So one client has part of the conversation, another worker has part of the conversation, maybe another worker has yet another part of the conversation. And everything sits behind queues. So there is nothing in the middle that can actually fail. And if any of the participants in the conversation here decides to die or decides to get an upgrade, then he can just simply step out. And because everything is queued anyway, he will pick up later in the conversation again to complete the rest of the workflow. So that's a very, very big difference. It allows for a lot more scalability in one end, but also for taking parts of the system down without having any impact besides slowing down the communication a bit. So sagas also used typically in the same use cases as workflows. They're actually kind of like contracts between your piece of software and the outside world for human to computer long-term interaction or for integration patterns. All of those kind of things, sagas are very useful. I will show you one later in the presentation how simple it is to actually build one. Okay, and then I think this is already the final pattern that we support. This is what we call the data bus. We support many types of queues, and it might be Amazon queue, it might be Azure Storage queues, it might be FTP, it might be something else. But all of these different infrastructures have different limits and different message sizes that you can send over them. And sometimes these message sizes are pretty small. Azure Storage accounts used to be 8 kilobytes, now it's 64 kilobytes. But if you want to send an image or a video through such a queue, it will not work. So that's why we invented the data bus, so that if you have a certain file or big chunk of data that you want to send as part of a message, then you can mark certain properties as this is a database property, and we will actually send it in multiple parts. So the message itself will still go over a queue so that we can get the durability and the ability for the listener to go down. But the other properties that have been marked will be sent as files through some kind of file store. In case of Azure, this will be blob storage. So that's the data bus. So we only support those communication patterns. One way, duplex, pub/sub, sagas, and the data bus. That's it. Okay. So we don't do web services. We don't do all kinds of things that require middlemen. We only want to work with the services that we have available in the system. And we want to ensure that everything can go down separately, can have its own life cycle, so that your service never has to be interrupted. Okay, now I want to switch to my desktop, I guess, to show you my personal project, which I can now use in all kinds of presentations. If you have seen this talk before, you know that I used to have a Flickr clone as part of this, but actually I was violating a lot of legal rules there, so I decided to build something myself. So the purpose of this service is actually for personal use at home. It will provide features for managing your daily tasks at home, your inventory. It will allow your wife to give you work and follow up on your work, things like that. Right? So I've built that. I will log in and I will show you a couple of features. I will use those features as samples in the code later. I cannot run it on this machine because I've chosen to use the Azure Service Bus in TCP mode as a integration, as a means to integrate. I hope Facebook gives me something. Is it blocked here, so? No? I'll try Live ID. Okay. Give me Live ID. Come on. Okay, so we'll show you a couple of features that allow you to see how it works. I will go, for example, to my office, and there you can see the work that I have to do. And I can just simply drag and drop, right? I can move tasks that I still had to do and move them into the done folder or into the to-do or in progress. And that's basically it, right? All of the actions that I take will be recorded and sent to the backend for processing. I will not interfere with you as a worker if you are using the system. I will just simply pick up the changes, and whenever you go to the next page, it should be automatically there. So this is not using web services. This is using Ajax behind the screens, send messages back to the web role. The web role will propagate it into the system, whatever the system looks like, and the reactions to the system or to your action will take place in the background. So this is one of the features that I wanted to show you, is what happens if you move a task from to do to in progress, for example. That will be very, very basic feature set. Another one that I want to show you is using the data bus, in fact, for when you can take pictures and upload those. I should have taken a picture somewhere over here. Do we have a picture? No, whatever. Live ID picture. I don't know what it is, but you can see here that I'm uploading the picture and doing a lot of things with it in near real time. But the message is way too big to be sent through the queue. So I will also show you that as a feature. And then I have another one which is not yet live. It's the Sagas. But there is a store or a subscription, a way to subscribe to the service I'm building. And I will give you that as a sample as well. But I can't show you yet. So that's why I will go back for a while to my presentation. But if you see the code will be very simple. And you should be able to follow even if you haven't seen it in action. Okay. Now, the architecture of this service looks a little bit like this. Right? It's a distributed application with any number of components. So if I'm designing a system, I want to be infinitely scalable, basically. I want to have one very simple message handler, and I want to scale it out over maybe 50 servers, I don't know. Or I want to group a lot of my message handlers and all put them on one service just to simply save some money. Those are all supported ways of doing things. And if you follow the rules of an service bus, then you will be able to switch from one to the other. So you can start out on one extra small machine with all of your message handlers grouped together, and then over time as your system grows, you move functionality or services to another machine without impacting the system at runtime. So it can keep on running throughout that you upgrade. Now, just to simply explain the current situation, because it can change, right? We have a website, which is basic HTML or HTML5. It's CSS. It's a lot of JavaScript in the form of jQuery and SignalR. Especially SignalR is a very good match within ServiceBus. If you haven't seen a presentation on that framework, I suggest you do, because it's very, very interesting. SignalR basically will keep a WebSockets connection open with one of the web roles. So there are two web roles in this scenario, hosted in Windows Azure, and they provide the content of the site. But the website has a connection open at all times with one of those web roles to send and receive messages. On this site is created an MVC tree. It has SignalR, the server side, deployed, and it also has nServiceBus deployed, at least the libraries, right? It's not a, it's also just simply an assembly. It's not some kind of product. Every web role, every instance of it has a separate queue. So this allows me to do pub sub from anywhere into the system to the web role, so that on the one hand, I can update all caches in the different web roles to make sure that everything looks real time. And furthermore, it also allows me to find the connection of SignalR so that I can send a message back to the user. So we really get real time or near real time communication between a user and the backend, as you can have seen when we uploaded the picture. Right? It showed when it uploaded, it showed when it started processing, it showed when it was done. So this was all in real time or in near real time. The web role itself, besides receiving messages, it doesn't do anything with the data store. It reads from it, but it doesn't manipulate any kind of data. If there is something to do, some kind of command or an event that needs to be reacted to, it will always send it back to the backend workers. The backend workers will currently all host the business logic. And I have two kinds, one for business logic and one for infrastructural logic. The workers that are running the business logic will automatically forward all the messages that they receive to the worker that runs the infrastructure logic. The infrastructure only does two things today. It's auditing, so everything that you do will be put into an audit log so that I can track what you do. And furthermore, if something goes wrong, I will also keep track of your messages that caused the error to occur, so that if anything happens, I can always rectify it because I have the intent what you wanted to do. If you had put an action into finished, for example, I will have that message and I can replay it so that I can fix the problem without having to ask you to do everything again. Furthermore, the worker is the guy with most functionality. It will run sagas and it will need store for that. And it will also publish back to anybody that's interested in events. And that's why it needs a subscription store. I will talk to you later about all of the different options that you have for these in Azure. But this is the basic architecture, okay? So multiple machines all picking up part of the application, and I can move code around, I can add roles, I can add instances in a role, I can do all kinds of things with it to make sure that you are always getting the best service. Okay, now, how do you do it in a ServiceBus, all of this stuff? Because if you just simply look at the deployment itself, it's big. But to leverage it as a developer, if you combine Azure and ServiceBus, you really don't have to do a lot. The basic construct for handling all of the communication between the different participants is done through a message contract. And a message contract is nothing more than an interface, basically. With or without an implementation. You don't really even have to type the code for this class. If you want to, you can have nServiceBus generate steps or implementations of your interface if you want to, but I usually prefer to create specific classes. So in this case, it's a class called image uploaded. That's what happened, and I implemented the iMessage interface from nServicebus. This is the old situation. Since a few months, we support the capability for you to define your own interface or your own convention for how to find messages. This has the benefit that you can keep your assemblies that contain your message contracts, that you can keep those independent of the version of nServicebus. So you will never be blocked by any upgrade in, for example, the client, but you don't do it in the server or the other way around. You're not tied. You're loosely coupled in the contract now, and you're also loosely coupled in time, of course, by the queues. So that's it. You create a class with a bunch of properties on it, and you identify the class as being a message. In this case, I chose for iMessage in the documentation. In the code, I set a convention, so I use my own iEvent interface. I will show you in a second. Okay. Now, of course, you need to have some kind of code that responds to receiving the message. And this is typically done by implementing an interface called iHandleMessagesofT, where T is, of course, the message that you want to handle. And that's it. Okay? You just implement this interface in any assembly that is detectable by the bus. So if the framework that it will scan your bin folder, for example, in search of assemblies that contain this interface implementation. I know I said here reference, but it's not true. It just has to be in the bin folder or detectable by nServicebus, and it will wire everything together so that messages sent to it will be handled by this implementation. Okay? There's actually nothing else than that. You also have a component that wants to send or publish a message. And in order to allow you to do that, there is something called an iBus interface. And ServiceBus automatically uses an IOC container internally. And it will inject it either through the constructor or either as a property, will it inject it into the message handler or whatever class that you want to send a message from. Okay? So this is all out of the box, also nothing that you need to do for it. Unless you want to, you can still replace the default implementations if you like. But it's nothing more than just calling bus.send and add a new message instance to it, or do bus.publish and add a new message instance to it. All of the rest is actually auto-wired. Okay? So that's basically what you need to do. For Azure specifically, you have to do one more thing. And that is defining the routes that the messages have to follow. On-premise, you don't have to, because on-premise and ServiceBus components will start talking to each other through UDP and communicate with one another which instance can handle what message. But as UDP is currently not supported in Azure, I cannot provide it to you. So you have to manually tell if there is a message, for example, from the contracts assembly, you have to send it to the worker input queue. And that's something that you typically do in your app or web.config. Okay? If Azure supports UDP one day or another way for instances to do multicast to each other, then we can also automate this step, but currently you have to specify it. But I think that that's not too much work. Okay, great. Now let me show you in code what it looks like. Back to switching to my desktop. I have a Visual Studio. Here you see my roles. I have a website role, a worker role, and an infrastructure role. Here is my contracts assembly. And I wanted to show you what happened if, for example, an action was set in progress. I also said that I do not have a reference anymore to... I do. Okay. I'll kill it then. Should be no problem. I do not normally require a reference to nServicebus. But apparently I screwed up somewhere. Oh yeah, for something else. No, sorry. I need to put it back. Okay. This is not the correct one. I need it a little bit later for another example. And service bus. Voilà. Okay, but for this specific message, I don't need it. I have my own event base class, and I have my own event interface. And actually, for basic messaging, that's more than sufficient to make sure that the messaging is going to happen. Now, I have this action in progress event. And with ReSharper, I can easily figure out where it's being used. So on the one hand, I have these message handlers here that, for example, mark a project as ongoing if the action is related to a project. And I can see here I have a class which says I handle messages. In this case, it's two. You can do that. And you have a handle method which accepts the message and which executes some kind of logic, in this case updating the associated project. And anything that I require to execute this operation can be injected by the IRC container. There is nothing more than this two handle messages. So a message is sent to a certain endpoint. There is some kind of code running in this endpoint which can handle the message, and service bus will ensure that the correct message is called or method is called so that the message is handled, all within a logical local transaction. Okay. On the send side, that will probably be my website. In this case, it's a Signaler hub where I get a message instance in this method, and I will just simply forward it to the bus. So I'll do bus.send. Send is directed at the specific endpoint. Publish will be at anybody that cares. So in this case, it will be sent directly to the worker. Okay. So from a code point of view, that's it. You have IEvent implementation or IMessage implementation. You have IHandle messages of T, and you have bus.send. Okay. Back to my slide deck. Okay. Click. Okay. Right. As I said, and service bus is actually a framework. So it's a bunch of assemblies which have by default a certain implementation. By default, it will run on top of Amazon Q as a queuing mechanism. It will use Autofac as an IRC container. It will use Log4Net for logging. And it will use RavenDB in an in-memory mode for storage. Okay, now none of those are really Azure, right? So we will replace them where necessary by Azure services, and that's very easy to do as an implementer. You can just simply implement one interface for a specific capability. You handle everything internally that's specific to your service, and you can just simply plug it in into a service bus by means of a configuration. The configuration is code-based usually, and it has a Fluent API. So if you want to manually compose a process that runs and service bus stuff with different things than the default implementations, this is the way to do it. Right? So you have a configure class, then you have a with specification that tells it where the assemblies for your implementation can be found. For IIS, you have a specific one with web that can handle with temporary ASP.NET files and stuff. The container is chosen by builder methods. If you specify default builder, you will get Autofac. If you don't specify anything, it will also default to Autofac. So this one you don't really have to specify. There are other IRC containers out of the box. If you like Unity or if you like StructureMap or Ninject or whatever, you just simply specify the correct builder. Right? And you can also pass in your own instance of a container if you like, so that everything wires up. Log4Net, you can specify your own appender if you like. I did that for Azure. I will come back to that later. You can specify your own configuration source, so that the config will, for example, be taken from the web config file, or from the Azure service configuration file, or from a database, or from anywhere you like. You can specify that. You can specify your message queuing mechanism. For Azure, this is Azure message queue or the service bus message queue. You can choose how the instances of the messages are serialized. I have chosen for JSON. And you can specify quite a lot more than what I have specified here. There are a lot of options. But to make life a little bit easier for you, we also provide some default ways of doing things. And that's what we call roles and profiles. A role will actually define how a certain endpoint will be implemented, while a profile will define some of the behaviors. Okay, so there is a little bit difference. In Azure, to get the config that was on the previous slide, which was still 15 lines of code, anything that you have to do is have your role entry point specified. So instead of referencing the Azure role entry point, you reference the in-service bus role entry point. And you provide a class which has an interface that says, I configure this endpoint, and then you tell it how it should configure the endpoint, in this case, as a worker. You have alternatives as a client, as a timeout manager, as a dynamic host, and you have all kinds of these roles that allow you to specify how the internal implementation should look like. As a worker means that you will get almost everything. You will get subscriptions, you will get sagas. So it's the active pattern in, or the active participant in the conversation. Now, sometimes these predefined configurations are not exactly what you want. So you want to customize it a little bit. And in order to do that, you have to implement a class with the I want custom initialization interface on it. Then you will get a reference to the configure class, and you can specify again in code whatever you like to change. Right? Sometimes you have to turn on things, sometimes you have to turn off other things. That depends on what you would like to do. Okay. Now let me show that in code, how that looks like. I need to switch first, I guess. Content, stop. Okay, so we're back. So, for websites, you always have to specify it manually. This has a reason. In Azure, you actually have a website and a web role. And if you would inherit from the role, it would actually all be running in the backend. That's why you have to configure the frontend, so the website, manually. Okay, I can't really change that unless I would be very naughty and start overwriting global ASAX automatically and stuff. But that's a little bit dirty. So the way that you do this is just simply by calling the configure methods and then specifying whatever piece that you would like. For example, if you want to swap out the default iMessage implementation with your own, you can use the dot defining messages method. If you want to manually determine what assemblies you would like to load, in this case all except this specific one, you can do so. So you can switch anything on and off as you see fit or as you need. One thing to keep in mind in Azure, since that we are running IIS 7.5, you have to be very careful on when you call this method. Okay, so you cannot call it in application start anymore. Because the HTTP context at that point in time isn't available and you cannot set the Azure logging properties. Okay, that's related to IIS 7.5. It didn't occur in the past. It's known. But you have to postpone the configuration of the bus until the first begin request. And that's why I use the lazy construct. so that this value property is only called once on the first begin request. Okay, that's a little bit of an annoyance, but nothing that I can change. But this is a pretty easy way around it, so that you can manually call the bus. And for this one, which will actually interact with the diagnostics manager in the backend, you have to make sure that it's postponed until the first begin request. But you will also see that issue in other IIS 7.5 implementations. So it's not specific to Azure. It's also not specific to N-Service Bus. Okay, so that's for websites. That's the manual way. Now, if I look at the worker, then I have my traditional worker role class. And this one now inherits from a role entry point, but the N-Service Bus one, not the Windows Azure SDK one. In the backend, this, of course, also calls the Windows Azure SDK one, so that everything works in the cloud. If you want to specify how it should behave, then you implement a class, I configured this endpoint as a worker. And if you want to modify anything, you also have to specify, I want custom initialization, and then you can modify anything that you like. Depending on what you modify, you have to be a little bit careful with this one. Either it has to be on the endpoint configuration, or it has to be on a separate class. But if you do it wrong, and Service Bus will tell you. Okay, so it will throw an exception. It will tell you you have to implement it in this scenario in another class. Like, for example, if I want to run the timeout manager, this has to happen in another moment in the startup sequence. So it told me, can you please do this a little bit later? Okay. But that's basically it. So if you inherit from role entry points and you specify how it should behave and any exceptions that you want to make on this tender behavior, it will do all the magic for you in Azure. Okay, so that's it. Right. Back to my slide deck. Oh yeah, maybe one more thing. In your config, you can also start and specify stuff, right? So in certain scenarios, you want to control the name of the queue, connection strings, etc., etc. So specific properties, you can always set them either in the service configuration or in the web config, whatever you prefer. Okay, I will come back to all of the different options in the slide deck. If you don't specify anything, for the most, it's all defaulted. So it will usually default to your local storage. So use development storage is set to true. Okay. Takes a while to click. Okay. Right. Now, you've seen the basics. So you implement a bunch of interfaces, you send messages around, it's put into a host, and it will all magically work. But there are some specific implementation details that are good to know, both to know what is supported as well as what you can modify. Configuration for Azure is typically done using the Azure configuration source. You can specify your own if you like, but this one has specifically been created to support the service configuration file, but to allow fallback to upconfig. Because not everything that you can specify in upconfig can also be specified in the service configuration file. Mostly because the upconfig allows you to create a hierarchy of XML tags with, for example, also dictionaries of values in it. This is not codable in the service configuration file. Service configuration file doesn't really have a schema. It's just name value pair. So it's a little bit more tricky to get everything in the service configuration file. If it's simply the hierarchy of XML tags nested, then you can use a dot as a parent-child relationship. So for example, here you have key attribute equals value, which would have been in your upconfig, would be key.attribute equals value in the service configuration file. Nested XML tags, you can say key1.key2.attribute, okay? But I cannot, for example, do something like the application settings where you have this kind of dictionary of name value pairs. I cannot really map that into the service configuration file. So if you want to use that, you will still have to fall back to your application or webconfig file. Okay. Diagnostics, I've simply hooked into the default Log4Net infrastructure that's in there, but provided my own appender. This appender will take a relationship with the diagnostics manager, which is installed on every single Windows Azure machine, and it will communicate with it to set up logging. It can work with or without the Windows Azure diagnostics configuration file. So I prefer to do with, as this file is replicated across all of the machines. It has all of the settings in there. It's very detailed. You can control a lot. While if you don't use the Windows Azure Diagnostics config file, you are limited to the five configuration settings that I have provided, okay, which is basically nothing but the Log4Net configuration and the time that it needs to transfer the files to blob storage. So if you specify a configuration file, it will use that one, okay, whatever you specify in the configuration. For queuing, we can choose between the Azure message queue and another one, the service bus message queue. There are some differences in the way that you use them. Azure message queue is not really transactional. It's semi-transactional. It supports a peak lock mechanism. That basically means that if an exception occurs during processing, the message will reappear on the queue and will be processed later again. To avoid you from going poor with this, it also supports a backoff mechanism, so that if there are no messages, then it will slow down the reads from the queue so that you do not have to pay for doing nothing. It also supports batching, so you can read 10 queues at the same time, or 10 messages. And you can either specify it to share it between the different instances of a role or to have one specifically per instance. For workers, I typically share. For websites, I typically specify per instance. This also depends if you have, for example, a caching service or memcached or something that actually replicates data already across your websites. You will go fall back to shared again. Okay, so it differs on your setting. You also have some things that you can fiddle with, of course the connection string, but also how long a message should be invisible, how long it should wait if there is no message, the batch size, etc. So you can twiddle with all of those settings. The other queuing mechanism supported is the service bus message queue, with that difference that the service bus message queue currently is only implemented in TCP mode. Okay. There is also a REST API for this queue, but I haven't built that yet. I also don't really see the need at this point because I already have storage queues that allow me to do HTTP communication, and the service bus message queue allows me to do TCP communication, so I'm pretty much covered. The only reason why you want to prefer service bus in HTTP mode over storage queues, I think, is the message size. And of course, the extra features that you get, like replay detection and stuff like that, if you really need it. This is also semi-transactional. It's also peak lock mechanism, so if a message is not processed, it will be redelivered a little bit later. I do not have to implement a backoff mechanism for this type of queue, because it actually supports it natively. You can service bus actually specifies to wait for like example 30 seconds until there is a certain message, so it doesn't keep on pulling. You have a lot of stuff to configure. Everything that you can configure on the service bus queue, you can also configure it in service bus, and it will propagate the settings to the service bus instance. Okay, to support PubSub, we need to store the subscription requests for every instance, for every role in the system. So if a client wants to know a certain event happened in the backend, then it will send a subscription message. But it's the backend itself, the machine itself, or the machines, that have to take care of storing the subscriptions. Okay? So the worker in my case will store the Azure subscriptions. It can do this either in table storage, or it can do this in SQL Azure. You can configure that. By default, it will be Azure table storage in a table called subscriptions. And you can change two things. One is where is the table located, and another one is if the table has to be auto-created or not. This is important, and Service Bus will by default auto-create anything. Okay, so normally you don't have to set anything up. If there is a queue that it requires, it will create it. If there is a table that it requires, it will create it. With one specific intentional thing that we don't create, we never create destination queues. So if a worker wants, or a website wants to send a message to a worker, and the worker doesn't exist and doesn't have a queue, this is actually a bug. Okay? So in that case, we will throw you an exception that says that the queue doesn't exist. This is intentional, because otherwise you would start creating queues whenever you create or make a typo, and that might not be the best idea for maintainability of your system. Okay. So besides using table storage for storing the subscriptions, we also have SQL Azure. This is actually out of the box. I didn't have to implement anything internally. There is an Hibernate option over RavenDB for Service Bus, and that one can already deal with SQL Azure. So it's simply a matter of switching out the connection string in the config file, and it will automatically work on SQL Azure. Okay? It doesn't use anything of the differences between SQL and SQL Azure, so it's completely compatible with both services or products. So you can simply switch. This is very interesting. Okay, for sagas, we have the same options. So we can choose for table storage. In this case, it will create a table for all the state of the sagas, a separate one. So every saga has its own table. I will show you a saga in a minute. And you can again specify where it has to be stored, and also if the table has to be created automatically, which is the default. For SQL Azure, exactly the same thing. Internally, this uses an Hibernate. And this also works out of the box. So you just specify a connection string to SQL Azure, and it will make sure that it works. That's basically it. Okay. I promised you that I will show you what a saga looks like, what it is. And I will do that again in my sample application. So this is something that is not yet in production. You can't play with it at the moment. And it's actually the payment module where you can sign up using PayPal. You pay for a certain amount and you get some services for a certain amount of time. Now this is actually a wizard that you will have to go through. You will first have to start the payment process. Then you will have to select how long you want to subscribe. Then you will have to go to PayPal to pay for the subscription. PayPal will send me a message back that the payment is completed. And but there can also be alternatives where the user cancels during subscription, or where the user just simply goes away and absolutely doesn't do anything. Okay, then it expires. Now, to track this and to see where in the process we are, I will use a saga. So in this case, how do you do that? You inherit from the in-service bus class called saga, and you provide it some information about how the data or what kind of data there is. And that you do by specifying I contain saga data. Okay? It's pretty clear what it does. It contains saga data. You have to provide three required properties, and besides that, you can pick any property that you like. Okay? We use an Hibernate to automatically detect the schema It will create all of the columns for you. It will make sure that the table is created in the correct form and that it actually just simply works. You have to take into account that if you choose table storage for storing this data, that you are limited. Okay, you cannot create very high hierarchical structures here, or relational structures, I should say. And also, you're limited in the number of data types that you can use, because table storage is also limited in that case. So if you have specific needs here for Saga state that are very advanced, you probably want to fall back on SQLizer. Okay. But that's it. It's just a class with properties. Those properties will be persisted in table storage or in SQLizer. Now, besides specifying what state you want to track during the conversation, you also specify a bunch of message handlers. So in this case, you put them all on the same class. And one of those is a specific interface which says, I am started by messages, and then the message type. So in this case, that the process has started. This one is obligatory because it indicates the start of the lifetime of the Saga. Okay? If any of the messages here occur before the I am started by message, you will not start the Saga and you will get some quirky results. So make sure that this one is always sent first in your business process. These can actually all happen in parallel. So that's also a main difference from a typical workflow, is that this is basically message or event driven, and we do not really know the order. So that's something that you have to keep in mind. Besides that, it's very simple. You provide the message handler for every message, and you do whatever you feel like doing. Okay, this could be just simply keeping track of data, and that's why you have the data property, which is of type, in this case, payment tracking data, and you just add data to it. This data will automatically be persisted for you. You don't have to call anything. As soon as you set the property and leave the method here, then it will be persisted. You can also finish the Saga, and that's done by mark as complete. You can do that in multiple places. For example, if it's canceled, if it's expired, or if the payment went through and everything happened. Okay, then you can simply mark as complete. This will actually physically delete the data from table storage. Okay, so that's the state is gone. And then one more, and that's why you need a timeout mechanism, is some of these processes can actually take quite a long time. So this payment process, I said that it can only take 1 hour in this case, but I can imagine that future business processes like the subscription itself will take months or years before any kind of timeout status is achieved. So you can also specify that. Okay, the infrastructure is durable. It will make sure that the timeout is called exactly at the point that you require. You can work with time spans, or you can work with specific dates. And you can also pass in the message that it has to send to you. So you can pass state around over time. So it will automatically take care of that. Okay? So that's a Saga. It's like a workflow. It's not as visual as, for example, Workflow Foundation. But that's also not possible, because if there is a conversation between multiple parties, every party has to keep track of its part of the conversation. So it's not on one place that you can find Saga data for a particular business workflow. But besides that, it's pretty easy to implement. You just have to specify in what cases, for what messages do you want to respond, and track the state of the conversation. Okay, so that's basically a Saga. Back to my slide deck. Where is it? Here you go. This always takes a while, apparently. Okay. Great. This is the last one, the data bus. So the data bus is designed for sending large large properties or large files mostly from one service to the other. And this uses block blobs in blob storage. Those blobs are uploaded in parallel. Message size, I think, by default is 4 megabytes. So if you have a file of 16 megabytes, then it will use 4 threads to upload 4 blocks in parallel. So it, usually every file should get at the other side pretty fast, given that you have a huge bandwidth in Azure, right? You're not really limited. I think you have 3 gigabytes a second or something, so it should go fast. It will automatically retry if one of the blocks fails. It will retry 5 times, I think, by default. So it's not possible that you get, or at least it shouldn't happen that you only get part of the files at the other side. You can also specify quite a lot of things, how often it should retry, how big the block sizes should be, how many I/O threads it can use to upload in parallel, and also the path in the storage container where you want to store the files, if you want to differentiate on that level. I can also show you that. So I've shown you the demo where I uploaded the picture. It would be sent to the worker role. It would be resized there in several formats. It keeps the original format. It creates a small thumbnail, a medium thumbnail, and then it will answer back. Okay, that's what happens. I will close these. And, of course, make sure you can see my desktop. Okay. I will start from the contract because we always start from the contract. User. Profile picture uploaded. Okay. So here we have a profile picture uploaded. And here is a service bus specific contract that you have to follow. You're required to both specify the byte array image that you want to send through the database as what is called a database property. And you also have to specify how long that and service bus should keep track of this raw byte array. Okay? So in this case, it's 24 hours. This property and this, this attribute and this property or type caused me to require the nService bus reference, right? We can't abstract this. But if you don't have any database properties, I promise you it will work without a reference to nService bus. Now, in this case, it will keep track of it 24 hours. Why can't I just simply clean everything up when the message is processed? Well, because I don't really know when the message is processed, okay? Because of the retry mechanism in most queuing systems, if a message fails, it will be put back into the queue. Depending on the infrastructure, it's either in front of the queue or completely at the back. So I have no clue when the message actually will be handled. So I can also not delete the file. I don't know when. So that's why we have to specify a time to be received, put it on something that makes business-wise sense, like a day or an hour or whatever that makes sense to you, okay? Just simply specifying this property will make sure that the content of this property will be split off the original message and will travel through the database. In case of Azure, you can turn on the database by specifying that you want custom initialization and call Azure Database as method. This will automatically refer to blob storage by default in your local storage. Okay. Now, on the other side, it's just simply, again, I handle messages, in this case, 3, one for the original file, one for the small thumbnail, and one for the medium thumbnail. And the messages will simply come in as if it were a non-database message. So, and service bus will make sure that the original message in the queue and the file in blob storage will be aggregated together again, and it will give it to you as a whole, and you can just simply access the byte array directly from the message. Okay? That's basically it. Right, so back to the presentation. I've gone over time a little bit, but I think we have something like 10 minutes left for this one and questions. I also said that you can actually choose in Service Bus how to host your message handlers. There are two types of hosts. One is a role is dedicated to a specific endpoint. That means that one complete Windows Azure machine is dedicated to handling a couple of message handlers, ideally just one. Okay. But you can also choose to combine multiple endpoints on one role. Both make sense. It just depends on how big your system is. Okay. And even in one system, you will probably have something really, really important that you want to host on a dedicated machine, and other stuff that might be not that critical and that you want to host together in a shared environment. Okay, so you can choose. How do we choose? First of all, one I've shown is you inherit from role entry point, and then you specify the role. It could be as a worker, as a listener, as a timeout manager. Those are specifics. And we also have as a host. And if you specify as a host, then it will not start a bus of its own, but it will look in blob storage for zip files that contain other in-service bus workers. It will download them, it will copy them on the disk, and it will start them as an executable on the Windows Azure machine. Okay, that's as a host. That's shared. In any of the configurations besides as a host, you have to specify profiles. Profiles in this case specify how you want the instance or the worker to behave. One is you can specify an environment. Currently, I support development and production. Development means that you will log to Visual Studio because that's the easiest way in development storage to track your exceptions. In production, it will log to with Log4Net to Azure Table Storage. You also have storage profiles. You can say that it has to store its data in table storage or either in SQL Azure. And you also have two communication profiles. One is use Windows Azure storage queues, and the other one is use the service bus queues. So you can switch. If you don't specify anything in the configuration file, it will be development on Azure Table Storage and using Azure Storage Queues. Okay, that's the default. Right. If you specify as a host, as I said, it will not start a bus of its own in the worker, but it will download other workers and run them as executables. And again, you have a lot of options. You can specify the connection string where it can find the zip files. You can also tell it how it should behave if any of the child processes has an error. It might either recycle the entire role or just simply keep the process killed, that it doesn't do anything. You can tell it to auto-update, so that if you want to deploy a new role to your shared host, you can just simply upload it into blob storage. It will pick it up automatically, shut down the old version, copy the new version, and run it again. Okay? So it has quite a lot of features that make life pretty easy to do shared workers. Great. Let me show that in code, because I also have a process completely in the backend that does that reads the audit queue and one that reads the error queue. Okay, it just tells me that there is an error. It will store the message so that I can replay it. But I don't consider this really crucial processes in the system. If it dies, it dies. Okay, it's not that big a deal. It will pick up the error messages later. So I have shared those on what I call the infrastructure host. And here I can show you. It's again just simply a worker role inheriting from role entry point. But in this case, I say that I configure this endpoint as a host. just simply by doing that, and then of course specifying the path in table storage where it can, or sorry, in blob storage where it can find the zip files containing the assemblies of these two workers. I'll show you. It will just simply pick up those bin folders, drop them on disk, and start the process. I can show you in the production environment, if it allows me. I have a blob container called, I have a blob container called infrastructure processes, and it contains two zip files, one for the outer queue processor and one for the error queue processor. These are both regular worker roles, so nothing special, also inheriting from role entry point, also having an endpoint configuration, etc. With one difference, these have to reference an executable called nservicebus.hosting.azure.hostprocess. This is actually the exe that will be run. It's a well-known exe. You can't specify your own. It has to be that one, so that the dynamic host can actually start your role, but running in a command line, basically, in the back, in the background. Okay. You do have to keep in mind that this is an executable, and you don't want it to be loaded by in service bus again. So you have to exclude it from the assemblies. And also, intentionally, I haven't given it access to this configuration file. Okay? It doesn't have access. You have to specify configurations in your appconfig. And the reason is because if you host different processes on the same machine, and they would all have the same configuration file, then they would all have the same configuration by default. So the entire point of co-hosting is a little bit pointless if everything starts reading from the same queue and everything starts writing to the same data store, etc. You really want to keep those things separated. If you then later move out of a shared hosting environment and you just simply add this back into the roles of the project, then it will still run because it fallbacks from service configuration to appconfig. But if you want to modify it, you have a slight change by moving the settings in appconfig into your service configuration file. Okay, but that should basically be it. If you want to scale it out to another machine, all you have to do is, one, move it, and if you want to change the config file, move the config settings as well. Okay, but you probably want to do that from a management perspective. So that's basically it. If you want to run this, you compile it, you go to Explorer, you take your release build, and it's not built at the moment, but you just simply copy everything that's in here into a zip file, and you move the zip file into your blob storage account, and that should be it.